That to because language is actually talking to the unconscious, and you just sort of listening in. That's why analysts use it, is because it's the only way of listening into the unconscious. So but you have to be able to interpret it, what's coming out in psychoanalytical terms.
It's a very interesting thought, isn't it? The innate forms that in spoken language, and the fact that some of it is sort of unconscious in the delivery. But like, say, driving is.
Yeah. Well, this is what Freud's great insight was, that you could tell everything in the language, which is why it's so important. And why it's so important to listen to what people like Putin and Trump and so on are saying, you know, because they're revealing themselves.
Yeah.
But they have to be interpreted. And it's in the interpretation. Everything's in the interpretation. And it's only very skilled people can actually pick out the meaning, because it's obvious that most people are misinterpreting. You know, Lee Anderson, it's a fantastic interview with him. I forget, I think it was Channel 4, but you could see his face and you could see that he did not understand.
I think I prefer that Cordonian rain filter you've got at the moment, but it has to be done. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yeah,
you could see his face, and it basically he was revealing him his inner thoughts.
Yeah, his non-comprehension of you know what he'd said, and the implications of it and how it worked. It just thrown it out as a kind of first level accusation that the mayor is just under the Islamists. Or controlled by the Islamists, or a gang of his, given it control of London to a gang of his friends, and so on.
That sort was the implication, really, wasn't it? I mean, and, you know, a sort of insidious, not quite libel against Mayor Khan.
And then you get Diane Abbott, and the guy saying that she, the comment, the original
Frank
comment,
Hester, that, yeah.
Makes people I just makes me want to hate all black women, and she should be taken out and shot. But then that gets reinterpreted, and now you're getting people saying that people are calling for the murder of Diane Abbott. So it's an example of the way, the danger of the hate speech. And the way it gets mistranslated or exaggerated or amplified in the translation or the repetition. And that's exactly how the process works. And it's why you get this, Bernard Burgoyne, this analyst in his paper, points to Freud's calling it a frenzied, you know, a frenzy of hate, and how does that work?
Sort of energetic thing. I mean, rather like the id, I suppose, in Freudian terms, yeah?
Yeah, Lacan doesn't use it, interestingly.
So it's a different sort of construct. It's a social construct.
But what he fundamentally agrees on is that everything hangs on the signifier and the signified. And this is what Lacan points to Freud and say, you know, if Freud did anything at all, you know, this is his great insight, to agree with Saussure's analysis of language, because everything is between the signifier and the signified. And that is what you interpret from in every word. You say a word, and what's that signifying to people? And that's where the misinterpretation comes.
You can start with something, I suppose, as simple as free association, and you will get to something fairly important quite soon, I guess, won't you? Because of the way the mind operates. Mal, welcome. You might wonder what we're talking about here. Graham has a friend, a colleague called Bernard Burgoyne, a psychoanalyst who might be appearing on the show at some future stage. And he was talking during the course of the week about Lee Anderson, if I'm not misquoting you, Graham, or Bernard, and also about the nature of the subconscious in the way that political ranting and rhetorical inaccuracy rears its head. You know, it has its sound and fury, and then it's analysed later on. Landis looking a bit like a rabbit caught in the headlights. What's your reading of what a generation or two ago would be regarded as a series of foot in mouth moments by Frank Hester, the Labour donor, I think, as well, talking about Hamas, and now Lee Anderson and Mayor Khan?
I'm not exactly sure what the question is.
I was rambling, wasn't I? I was basically thinking about the tendency of people who feel that they have power at the moment to issue their powerfulness in a way that is not only controversial, but tends to cause offence. As it were, overshooting their platform.
Some people do that, and they've always done that. You know, the political gaffe has a very long and almost honourable history. And sometimes, you know, as with, you know, Churchill's insults, could actually rise up to being almost wildly at some point.
There is a difference, though, isn't there? They're somewhat constructive.
Yes, yeah. I mean, there's, I don't know, was it constructive for was it Bessie Braddock who said, Winston, you are drunk, and said, yes, and you are ugly, but in the morning I will be sober. I'm not quite sure how constructive that was. But
cruising for bruising there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But very amusing. But, there is a, I don't know, there's a line being drawn, I think, by some in politics at the moment to... where almost, yeah, being shocking, and it applies to both edges of politics. There is a constituency that wants you to be as shocking as possible, and drawing the line between, you know, satisfying that extremist, whether it's Hamas-style extremism on the left, or you know, Lee Anderson, rather Islamophobic attacks on the right. Of trying to satisfy the extremes within the movement, while at the same time not completely losing touch with the more moderates. And I guess it's some sort of indication as to how extreme populism is. I'm back away a bit from saying rife. It's probably more prevalent at the moment than it has been for some time. There's still a lot of very sensible politicians out there. We shouldn't lose sight of that fact. But at the same time, there's an awful lot of those for whom being shocking. And you know, Trump is obviously the most obvious example in the world at the moment. But in British politics, we've got Galloway more recently, where the attempts to shock. They appear really quite deliberate, I think.
Have you been close to someone in politics who seems to be stepping up to that particular plate? Have you had occasion to talk them down, or has this been discussed perhaps when you're talking at a local level, when, as you did a little while ago?
I mean, Wandsworth has been blessed with, you know, generally with quite moderate voices in both the main political parties that have represented on Wandsworth Council for a long time. One couldn't accuse Eddie Lister or Ravi Govinda of being extreme right-wingers any more than one can accuse Simon Hogg of being an extreme left-winger.
Certainly eloquent.
There's been a sensible pragmatism and public spirit. And it is noticeable that the groups, we've just had a governance review published or released, it's not in public domain yet, but it will be, on how we run things in Wandsworth. And it does at several points make the point that personal relationships between the two parties tend to be pretty good. That's not to say that we can't fall out into a degree of what I would probably term as childishness from time to time. But generally speaking, the personal relations and the respect across the chamber and respect to officers is pretty good in Wandsworth. So we've been lucky in that respect compared to some of the more extreme councils on both left and right that have always something to say infested other areas of the country.
Is it due process that keeps that in check? Again, I'm thinking perhaps of what Graham might say in terms of the Constitution, which we've always thought of as a sort of gentle person's agreement, but there is a to quote a favourite shop sign of mine down in Stratford, a sort of service and civility that we've always had that people, I guess, miss, and people miss in the Conservative Party, for example. Not exclusively the Conservative Party. But how do you engineer this, and how do you therefore build it back in?
Well, I think that's what the Constitution has been doing. That's its role, is to instill civilised behaviour between people.
Yeah. But Lee Anderson was the deputy chair of the Tory Party, so he had responsibility for this sort of thing, didn't he, for sort of disciplinary matters.
Yeah, well, this is why it's so dangerous and so alarming that these senior Tory figures, they're all Brexit and this is what you get from Brexit. You know, you can't avoid the effect of Brexit. There's a very good programme on the rise and fall of Boris Johnson.
There are thoughts about him rising again, aren't there? Possibly assisted by some form of steam traction. But yeah.
But that takes him apart as to how he failed and what a big failure he was. Michael Heseltine saying that he's made the biggest diplomatic gaffe in history. So,
and he's a man who, you know, could say that in a fairly informed way. It's been around a while.
Well, I did make an artwork of him, his decision making process.
This must be seen. Please send me a little diagram. And disturbing as it may seem, I think the nation needs to behold this.
Well, it predicted that he would not be able, as a politician, you know, to reverse Brexit when he realised that it was a huge mistake, because he wasn't as great as Churchill as he'd hoped and aspired to, but he doesn't have it in him, and this is the problem that all politicians face is when they realise their dream of ultimate power. I mean, it's just a quite extraordinary story how someone like Boris Johnson got into the top position, then self-evidently fail and fall apart. And that's the link with the issue that Malcolm is always referring to, is this the man in the street and the man on the doorstep. And it's his perception. I would contend that he's doing the analyst job of listening to all the speech of the politicians and seeing into their unconscious as to what their real motives are. And that's what he's voting on, is their assessment of his real motives. That's why the social media are so dangerous, is that they know all these psychological tricks to persuade people to vote the way they want. And so they're disrupting democracy, you know, by perverting democracy. And I think that's what's playing out across the world at the moment with these high-tech companies.
Mm.
And is bound to only get worse with AI.
I wonder, these things are presumably forming a sort of idiolect, a sort of language, aren't they, in a sense? So you look at these things that appear on your homepage on the internet, and clearly the construction, particularly if it's artificial, has a certain format to it, the way that newspapers have styles. So I'm thinking that perhaps to some extent people will start to know what they're in for.
Yeah, well, this is people learn languages, and it's not only verbal languages. You know, people learn visual languages.
They learn individual languages, as you say. Yes, you put
environmental languages, cultural languages, musical languages. Mm. So the voter is reading all of these languages to his own or her own degree, and that's what they're making their voting decisions on, not on what the politicians are saying on the surface, if you like. They're giving speeches, but everyone has the ability to read between the lines, I think.
And I suppose at some level, a political deliverer will seek to tap on some of the unconscious needs that are being expressed by voters that they may have sort of sought to determine.
Well, they won't make the decision on the actual sentences they speak. They'll make their decisions on whether they fundamentally trust the person. Right. This is why lying is so important. That people do not trust liars.
Mm. Do you think that we now that we are still in an age where people are looking for trust, or do you think that they're looking for substance of a different kind? In other words, that a sort of realpolitik that says that these people are not perfect, they're not avuncular as once we thought they were, but they are at least delivering on something.
Well, the whole underlying concept of representative democracy is that most of what is going on is far too complex for any of us as individuals really to understand. And I certainly have, there are a few areas of life where I think I know a thing or two, but there are huge areas of life about which I know, next to nothing, if not absolutely nothing.
And the nature of being a busy person.
I certainly recognize that putting together a policy or a set of policies for society that will balance all of the various needs is enormously complex and needs people who we empower to take those decisions on our behalf. Otherwise, you fall into a democracy that just has a string of referenda on which people take decision, which inevitably many of us would not feel we're competent to take. And maybe Brexit was a very good example of that. The concept really behind representative democracy is that we trust the people that we elect. If we don't think they're doing a good job, then we elect somebody else when the time comes round. But in the meantime, given, of course, that any politician worth their salt will delight in finding out the opinions of the people that they serve and understanding the issues as far as they can through the eyes of their constituents or people in their ward or whatever. But nonetheless, at the end of the day, the politician's duty is to take the best decision that they see given all of the evidence, not the decision that's going to please the greatest number of people. And to do that, we need people that we can trust to do it. So I think it's, in simple evolutionary terms, it's by far from surprising that rather than us trying to make up our minds on each individual issue that may come before us in real time, as it were, we gravitate towards leaders who we trust have our best interests at heart and are intelligent enough to grasp these issues to take that string of decisions for us. And as someone who is strongly of the view that representative democracy is the best thing we've come up with yet as a way of governing society, then it follows from that. But I think it's entirely appropriate that people should be taking their decisions based on a combination of trust and so trust in the sense of believing the well intentions of those we're electing, but also trust in terms of their competence as well. And that combination of taking us in a direction that we think we want to go and the abilities to take us there mean that we have traditionally elected people where we might not agree with them on every individual thing. I can't think of any politician ever who I've agreed with on absolutely every bit of policy. But it's very important that we trust them sufficiently and empower them to take those decisions on our behalf.
You make such an eloquent case, which, if I remember rightly, is sort of Edmund Burke territory, which you're a great espouser. Graham, I'm going to throw in something to the mix in this sort of general realm, but can I ask you to comment on what Malcolm said? How does it resonate with you?
Yeah, no, I agree with almost all of that. And that's the concrete example of Michael Gove.
You got there before I did.
Who I was against in my case on the Thames Tunnel.
Mm.
Is that
he's at it again, isn't he? Yes.
Yeah, he's at it again. He's wanting to introduce new laws to have the force of the community behind him, but he can't be trusted because he has an ulterior motive, and that's what he did after the Thames Tunnel case. He tried to introduce changed the law so that increased people's liability if they took judicial review, and therefore decreased the number of judicial review cases under the pretense that he was improving planning law. Whereas actually what he was trying to do is simply put all the decision-making in the hands of the politicians to say that it's only the minister who takes the decision and not the people.
But constitutionally, that has pretty wide ripples, doesn't it? Because it would apply to pretty much any issue.
And that's exactly what the danger of changing the constitution is. Mm. The constitution, as I keep pointing out, has taken 800 years. And it's the depository or repository, which it's the end result is the wisdom of the society, the civilization. It embodies the civilization. That's why it's such a catastrophe to break with the European constitution, which is also unwritten, by deception. You know, which Michael Heseltine keeps pointing out.
Mm.
You know, Boris Johnson, he was lying, and they were all lying about the 310 million per week. It's an outright lie. So, I mean, they should be held to account, and they have been held to account. Boris Johnson's been held to account, but Michael Gove hasn't.
Well, he seems to be an extraordinary old bruiser, and he's a survivor. He's acquired a reputation as being a maverick, a deal maker, certainly someone with his sort of Walter Winch-like ear to the ground in the Commons. And this week, he's been, I think Dominic Cummings moved in this direction a couple of years ago, but he's been talking about extremism and groups that the government might either cut off funding to or not have truck with. And one or two are on this list, and the definition has changed subtly. I'm wondering what our reading of that is, and what our reading of Gove is in relation to, again, to this idea of trust, and that he has held things together, but some people would sort of trust him as far as they could throw him within the Houses of Parliament, I would think. Maybe that's true of several people.
Yeah, and it all comes out in his language on film. This is the disadvantage of social media for the politicians, is they get quoted and requoted. And it's rather unfair to have something you said 10 years ago brought up as if you'd said it yesterday.
The Byline Times points out the fact that he's on the secretariat of the Henry Jackson Institute, which, amongst other things, is quite fervently anti-Islamic. The sort of Steve Bannon tendency is in their American chapter to this day. Anyway, the connections are fascinating, you might say, in the course of free speech, as Gove himself does. Mel, what about Gove and trust?
Well, Gove has a number. He's a very intelligent man, clearly, and he this is one of the downsides of party politics, is that you do end up almost. I'm sure he doesn't believe half of the things that he says, but has to say, or several of a lot of the things he said. But it's kind of the script of party loyalty, just like Keir Starmer when he was in Corbyn's shadow cabinet had to.
And is that still okay? I'm thinking as a sidebar, but sorry, you were saying yes, yeah.
Had to, yeah. That you sort of have to support what's going on in your own party, even if it's distasteful. I think it's very unfortunate. So I wish more politicians wouldn't be quite that tribal, but I can kind of understand it. Having had 20 years as a party elected representative in my distant past. But at the end of the day, we have elections. So all of the polls very, very consistently are giving Labour around a 20-point lead. There's a sense that that there is nothing that it looks at the moment, I mean, famous last words, but it looks at the moment like there's pretty much nothing the Conservatives could do to turn that round. We'll have looks like May has been ruled out for an election, unsurprisingly. But the sands are running out very, very rapidly for the Conservatives. And that's ultimately, or whatever goes on between elections, the big check in our democracy is what goes on at a general election. And parties can't get away forever with trying to fool all the people all the time.
Yeah, and I think the public have now caught up with Brexit and have realised what a disaster it is. That's why I think Keir Starmer is playing a very dangerous game by not distancing himself from Brexit before the election.
It's not really,
opening the gate,
Brexit
you know,
isn't really, certainly not directly, it's not terribly high on the, I think you're right, and I think there is a, you know, quite a bit of buyer's regret developing. Having said that, it is very clear still that the majority of those who voted for Brexit would vote for Brexit again, even if the majority of the country would be the other way around now. But it's not directly about that. It goes back to this not being purely driven by perceptions of individual policies and individual areas of realities, as it were, but it being equally important what the general sense of decay is. And there's a real sense of decay and meaningless about this government now. There is more talk about replacing Sunak, perhaps with Penny Mordaunt, seems to be the latest one on that. But it would just be completely farcical since the last general election, the Conservatives would now move on to their fourth leader, there having been two before that in fairly quick succession since the 2015 election. The idea that switching to your sixth prime, I'm getting this right, aren't I? Sixth prime minister in very few, you know, very little more than 6 years, in sort of 8 or 9 years, is going to do anything out there is, I think, probably farcical. I think they're probably better. I mean, it was very interesting. I was looking at the statistics in May 1997, when Major went to the country in on the same day as the local elections in May 1997, and even though it was this massive swing against the Tories, and we got this enormous Blair majority, but in local government the Tories made a net gain of over 160 seats, while Labour made a net gain of one, and the Lib Dems were very, very heavily hit. And I know that the national parties don't take local government terribly seriously often, but the network of, you know, the local campaigns is very much done through, you know, the local associations and their locally elected councillors. And part of me has thought if Sunak was thinking about the long-term future of the Conservative Party, going on May the 2nd might have made some sense, because a lot of Conservatives who will not bother to go out on the 2nd of May because it'll only be local elections and they're really fed up with the National Party, and this is a kind of cost-free way of saying that. But if there's a general election on the same day, as we saw in 97, then that the effect of how unpopular the party is gets outweighed by the fact, well, a lot of Conservatives will go to the polls because it's a national election, they think they ought to. And while they are there, they'll vote for their local Conservative candidates in the local elections as well. That because there's a real chance that the Conservatives will be all but wiped out in the May elections that are coming up. And there's some really quite important ones. You know, obviously, Mayor for London and the London Assembly is one. But there are many elections right the way across the country, in district councils, in major cities, and so on. And if the Conservatives lose pretty much another generation of activists through that, it's going to make the eventual comeback all the more difficult. So I don't know. The arguments about, you know, when to go to the country and how to take it depend on whether you just want to hold on to power for a few more months in the increasingly unlikelihood that something's going to turn up, and then maybe change your leader yet again as a final futile gesture. On the other hand, you know, taking a longer term view for the party, going earlier might actually make it a little bit easier to start to rebuild from the ashes.
I think that petition makes a lot of sense. I wonder if I could just ask you whether extremism, in terms of the Gove pronouncement this week, it's a factor here. Some of the editorial comments about the Penny Mordaunt spectre and elsewhere in the party are talking about the fact that there is this need to guard against the right, or the far right, as it were. Anderson, having gone to Reform UK, this is still resonating. And the implication, perhaps, is that the Conservative Party, as is a bit of a runaway train, or is pulling in two directions that weren't sufficiently resolved.
Yeah, well, I think we are witnessing the disintegration, and it's through the ideology, because the ideology doesn't add up in the end, and they've started insulting each other and using racist and anti-Semitic.
But the stuff actually appearing, at whatever point it appears in the food chain, is significant in itself, say implicitly.
Well, the people that are representing, you know, their funders, when their funders start being racist and being called out, and people can witness the racial slurs and so on. I think it has a major effect. I mean, everybody understands racism from that point of view, and they can watch this playing out, whereas they can't watch something like global warming. I think very few people have an understanding of global warming, and it's why it's more or less been taken out of the hands of democratic populations. Because it's now been taken over by the super rich, which hopefully they will sort it out by the policy changes that they're introducing.
I'll get back to, yes, yeah.
Nobody at the voting level can understand or gauge, you know, that whether the world is being saved or not by the policies. it's certainly not being saved by laying all the blame onto the perpetual consumers.
Mm. To use an old saw, he who pays the piper calls the tune. You've often referred to this government's sort of affectionate relationship with fossil fuel companies. Likewise, in America, mainstream politics on both sides is not unconnected to it. But in America, you sort of know what you're getting, don't you? Because there's a fairly explicit system of knowledge, of lobbying, and philanthropy and political activity is funded very often by these very large investment trusts, of course, as well as big companies. Now, Hester's health tech company benefited directly from government contracts. So there's there's another plank of this that would perhaps be okay across the pond, but is perhaps potentially a new thing over here. Now, again, if we're thinking about trust, is this significant? And also, when people are making these kinds of donations, where's the etiquette that says they should just, you know, pay up and shut up? Or should they?
Well, it's the distortion that the rich have in buying freedom of expression in the democracy.
I like that phrase, buying freedom of expression. That's very, very, you know, ironically weasel. Yeah. Mm.
Well, and as someone pointed out, he pays 10 million. And so that gives him a bigger voice than anybody else. And it turns out to be a very unpleasant voice.
The word money talks, but in the wrong way.
Yeah. Like money talks. Money doesn't talk. It just goes without saying.
Mm.
But there has been a report come out on the decade of the Lobbying Act, which I didn't know much about. So we are gradually improving, you know, the workings of the lobbying, which is, I mean, lobbying is obviously necessary. I mean, that's part of the political behavior in general. It needs regulating so that it's done in a fair and democratic way. So it's not actually wrong to lobby. It's about how it's done. And it's the same with Gove and his anti-extremism.
Indeed, some of his lobbying tendencies have been called into question. Yes, yeah.
He spent all his credibility, unfortunately, like Johnson. So people simply won't trust him anymore, and they'll assume that there's something ulterior, an ulterior motive behind it. It's clearly a very good idea to introduce new regulation to protect liberal democracy, parliamentary democracies.
It's a refreshing sign in what people feel are you know, at times that could slide us away from parliamentary democracy.
Yeah, and the that's a good example of social media, and the way the whistleblowing is not the dog whistling
yes.
against modern liberal ideologies is working, and Xi Jinping and Putin are really persuading the whole of Africa that we should pay for our imperialist past, which on the face of it is a very good idea, but. You know, they're not taking into account of what they're getting in place.
Courtney had reports this afternoon that some people have set fire to the old polling station. I suppose that would make a you know an interesting graphic for social media. But as you say, others aren't available.
Yeah, there are some very good graphic cartoons coming out. the one of Rishi Sunak. At the bottom, a very big hole that he's digging is a good one. and the other one that, that Channel 4 uses of the elephant in the room standing on the table. Superb graphics.
Yeah, after a long lunch, no doubt.
I think they're all indications that the social media is gradually being understood by the general public, as opposed to simply following the bad actor theory, where the new technology is simply followed, and the first people to follow it are the people who are against the law and the bad actors, before the law takes time to put its boots on.
That's a heartening thought. But who's issued this report saying the lobbying dynamic has improved? Is more jurisprudent? Do you happen to know?
The report on the decade of the lobbying act.
Yes, yeah.
That's a New Statesman report.
Oh, right, yes, Andy Marr and those guys. Well, that's, it's interesting because they're not averse to the odd advertorial. I mean, they've got to make a living. But yeah, they're quite transparent about it.
So an insert that, you know, came...
Yes. Oh, yes, yeah. Now, this business of lobbying is, again, I suppose, a Burkean archery of democracy. Had it been worrying you, and is it something that is getting the reform that it needs?
Well, lobbying is essential. I mean, people and companies and anyone who's got a case to make has a right to make that case to their elected representatives. Where it gets messy, and I think the row has been more about party donations and the lack of transparency around some of this. And Labour's starting to get itself in the same boat today with Gretchen Reeves. Yes. Gretchen Reeves this week saying that that Labour would not declare who they were talking to with big business. And the staggering amount of money from the Tory donor, 10 million up front, and then you know, news of another 5 million. But for a political party, donation of 10 million is staggering. It's vast. And you know, the usual form of words is they're not doing it to get particular policies changed. It's because they believe in the policies that we would pursue anyway. Yeah, well, maybe. But 10 million, I suspect, probably focuses the mind a bit when policies are being written. We remember the first moment where the shine started to come off Tony Blair was over the Formula One donations and suddenly
Eccleston, who was eventually indicted. Yeah,
allowing tobacco advertising in Formula One racing. So that's where it falls down. I think lobbying as such, yeah, I'm frequently in my sort of tiny little local role being lobbied by people who don't like this planning application or don't like what's going on in the roads in this particular way. And, quite rightly so. That's a very important part of our role is to listen to cases that people are making and to make up our minds. And if we think the case they're making is a good one, then to do what we can to see if we can get policies implemented to support it.
And in your case, there wouldn't be a financial element. It's pro bono, isn't it?
No, of course. I mean, absolutely not. I did, it's very sweet. I got one of my residents, this first time it's happened. Actually, no, that's not fair. There's a couple of residents who will usually give me a sort of bottle of some low alcohol punch at Christmas
Mm.
with some homemade cookies, which are just delightful. And one resident gave me a half bottle of vodka. I haven't touched alcohol for 18 years now,
Blimey. Yeah.
but he because I got there was a problem with a very badly kept dog, and I sort of took this through, and our dog people event now seem to have got problem
Hopefully not the
solved.
dog wasn't on the vodka.
But I've always made it very, very clear that, in fact, I'm a bit, because it was only, I mean, I guess £15 worth of value. I took the gift. I'll probably, because I don't drink it myself, I'll probably pass it on as a raffle gift or something at some point.
Sound
But
policy.
always make it very, very, very clear to people that, it's nice if people show gratitude after something like that, but it's entirely unasked for, and makes no difference at all to how seriously I'll take a. In fact, I didn't know anything about this until after the event, and I thought it was very sweet, but slightly. No, it was very sweet to me. It was a nice gesture,
I
but
remember this
certainly not.
some yeah so need in working with modern slavery clients there were in
Yeah, I mean,
Albania it's very it's customary to give gifts. I couldn't accept them, but there was some offense caused initially. It's just it's a thing.
most recently, with the All England Club's application to develop the former golf course, and obviously I've had a number of meetings with the All England Club about this, but it's just far more comfortable. And they, not through wanting to apply any sort of undue influence at all, but they've invited me to lunch at the club, or did it once, and we just agreed that it was uncomfortable to do it like that in case it wouldn't do them any good to for an impression to be there that they were trying to buy me off, which they weren't at all. That wasn't in their mind. So
But the
we,
optics,
and so I do, I'll accept a cup of coffee and maybe a little, chocolate brownie or something from them. But that's as far as we go. And it's just far simpler to do it like that, and not ever have the suggestion arising that I'm being influenced by anything outside. And the vast majority of local government is like that. In fact, I think the majority of MPs are like that as well,
Well,
that
I was going to
we're
say,
generally not.
I was wondering if there is a connection there. I mean, somebody was one of the clips that in another part of the forest that was said to me. Somebody on I think it was an Indian web channel, aghast at the amount of champagne that's consumed in the House of Lords. Now, I'm sure that's not actually any arrangement with any particular manufacturer or procurer of these things,
Well,
but it is.
the rules are much, much stricter for local government than they are for parliaments. I've never really understood why.
That's
We have
it.
to declare any gift over £25, I think it might have gone up to £50 in value, we have to declare. But actually, I don't know of any councillor that would dream of accepting a gift, a kind of in advance type gift or an expensive lunch or anything from anybody. I just don't know of any councillors that would think that's appropriate. I remember once when I had the housing portfolio, I sort of did the phone call of digging the first sod for a new housing development, and they gave me the spade which they had inscribed. And at that stage, I didn't really have a garden, so I had nothing to do with this spade. But I had to declare it because it would have cost more than £25 to make this spade, even though it was completely useless to me, and because it had my name on it, useless to pass it on to anybody else either. So you can get some quite amusing sort of side developments like that. But in Parliament, there's not that same restriction on, accepting a very agreeable lunch at an expensive London restaurant or restaurant in your constituency or whatever. And I think probably there should be. I think probably local government's got it right.
You've knocked around the House of Lords from time to time, Graven, in a very honourable and pro bono way. But do you think there's something in the culture that is, shall we say, vulnerable in that sense, in terms of the hard hogness of it at
Well,
times?
the whole architecture is meant to impress and put people in awe. I remember once being shown around the foreign secretary's office, which is a fantastic room, and the map on the wall is very impressive, but we were shown how this map could be changed to give different versions for according to which visitor was having a meeting in the room.
Good heavens. And this is not modern technology, presumably, but this is some device from...
Empire technology.
Wonderful. Which still is intact and maintained.
Yeah. Yeah, but...
extent, the House of Lords is a heritage object as well as being a functioning body, isn't it? So therefore has to be well-oiled a bit.
Yeah, it's a fantastic example of the importance of art and culture.
Mm.
That's how the hidden messages are conveyed, and it's very productive in producing the right results. You know, to take someone out of their own space into someone else's space that they're totally in control of, and to be impressed, so they come to agree with you. I mean,
I suppose the flip side is that, and perhaps the implication is there are some people who are habitués of both houses, but perhaps are a little bit more blasé.
It's the degree to which people learn how to use it to their advantage, I guess.
Yes. But,
I mean, you can't. I don't think you can knock the building. And I'm always saddened, basically, by people who say you have to get rid of all this totally irrelevant processions and grandeur and so on, because it misses the function of the whole thing. It's to make it serious. You know, to create an environment is for serious decisions and serious consideration.
The power of ritual to induce that frame of mind.
Yeah, if you get rid of all the ceremony, you get rid of all the seriousness. You know, and I think that's what's happening if you lower the standards. I mean, all these, like manners. You know, manners have a particular function of making human relations flow easily.
We do get very exercised, don't we, about the speakers of the House of Commons, for example. Burko has been rehabilitated now because Lindsay Oyl ignored Diane Abbott 49 times, we're told.
Yeah, that's quite extraordinary. I mean, what's the parliamentary procedure basis of that? I mean, you would have thought that was the perfect occasion that she would have an absolute right to speak on her own behalf.
It was ad hominem, wasn't it, what was being said, or what was being, you know, it was the Hester case.
Has anyone pointed out what the parliamentary procedure was that he could block her?
I wonder.
Well, isn't her,
in procedural terms, I guess, that there's only a limited number of questions can be taken in the time available. And the Speaker, you know, chooses one MP rather than another MP, but somebody wouldn't have been able to ask their question. Having said that, so I suspect, and I don't think
it's the optics, isn't it?
Follow,
yeah, it's
such,
not just
in
optics.
Terms of the optics, look appalling, absolutely dreadful. The way that I don't like Diane Abbott, and I think some of her opinions actually do border on racism themselves. But there is no doubt whatsoever that the way she particularly has been treated, actually. All women MPs, and particularly black women MPs, seem to get this appallingly, but maybe her more than any other, is just a complete and absolute disgrace in a so-called civilized society. And she has shown enormous courage through the years in facing up to that. And in a week when there is this specific, you know, furore about comments that were made about her as an individual, It just smells so very strongly that there's something else going on than just that she didn't happen to catch the speaker's eye. And I think, you know, this is another, I'm afraid, very serious question over the judgment of this particular speaker after the decision to, in effect, scupper the Scottish National Party's opposition day motions on Gaza. Some 3-4 weeks ago, where he clearly went against established procedure there. And this coming on top of that, it just does not look like good judgment at all. And I can absolutely, you know, say, without being a fan of Ms. Abbott's particular policy in some areas, but in terms of the way she's been treated, as you say, I think she, of all people, should have had an absolute right to ask her question at that stage. And the fact that she wasn't does kind of smell of some sort of conspiracy going on against her.
So given that the Speaker sits surrounded by procedural advice and often pauses to get the correct Erskine May citation, it seems to be a role that's open to a lot of leeway and interpretation than the extremists, some people suggesting, can be sort of bought.
Yeah. And I think it demonstrates the use of candlelighting in Parliament, where the politicians seem to sort of gang up on each other and spread rumours.
Gaslighting, yes. Yeah.
Gaslighting, yeah. So I said candlelighting.
Yeah, what if only?
Gaslighting. gaslighting, right. because she suffered, I think, from that. And it's where the gaslighting and anti-Semitism accusations sort of overlap and get blurred, and people don't distinguish between what is actually going on. And that's where the analysis comes in, the psychoanalysis, if you like, which you have to take the words that are used as the primary indicators or signifiers, as Alice would say.
So everything is medicine, isn't it? You know.
Well, it's the role of Hansard is so it can be referred back to.
Indeed. And it must sometimes read like one's teenage diary, I suppose, to senior parliamentarians.
Yeah, there was someone who defended Diane Abbott's previous accusation of anti-Semitism, that white people don't experience racism.
That's what she said, the level of it, the constant
level of black people.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that she was actually trying to express a very nuanced point, you know, which was a valid point. And she got shouted down almost by the anti-racist name. That's the kind of thing that is just impossible and is a failure of you know, speaking in public, you know, where you get caught out. Because I think there is a lot of self-censorship of people not being able to speak their mind because they're worried about making a slip of the tongue.
And therefore being dubbed extremists before they can say their piece, before they can give the context of the rules, as you say.
Yeah, and people take
it. And that's the paradox. That's the paradox here, is that on the one hand, and it's a very difficult line to draw, that on the one hand, we, you know, I think as a society, we should be, you know, condemnatory of language that is clearly extreme
to manufacture the search, yeah.
Yeah, and designed to incite racial hatred, be it Islamophobic or anti-Semitic or whatever. But on the other hand, if we get to a point where nobody dare say anything in public for fear of, you know, saying, I remember Dominic Cumberbatch of all people, Benedict Cumberbatch, sorry, of all people, at one point making a point about how few people from various minority backgrounds are to be found in the arts, and used the term coloured people and was absolutely jumped on because what he should have said was people of colour, not coloured people.
It's a bit of South African in his background, as they might have been referring
entirely to losing sight of the point that he was making, which was that there seems to be, whether it's right or not, but the point he was making was there seems to be some systematic racism in the arts that needs to be addressed. But because he chose the words that are out of fashion at that particular moment, for all I know, might be back in fashion by now, then that's what gets jumped upon, not the serious point that he's making underneath it about a, you know, a lack of representation of certain groups within the arts at that stage, and particularly the performing arts. And it's we do see it, and the problem, of course, is, and we've seen it time and time again, we're seeing it in the trans debate at the moment, that you then start getting the backlash, and a point suddenly comes where what looks to me like genuine transphobia, which is, you know, making disparaging remarks to people and making them uncomfortable simply for the fact that they are transgender, is beginning to re-emerge when that had, largely, I don't know if it had died out, so it's not something I was particularly aware of one way or the other, but it seemed not to be anything like as common as it was 20 years ago, from what I remember. But when the militant arguments come forward and people get accused of being transphobic because they are concerned at the idea, it's that 60% of the weightlifting records and titles in the States now are held by transgender women. You have people who are now demanding to be able to 50-year-old biological males demanding to be able to go into changing rooms with adolescent girls. And the idea that anybody who is worried about that and sees that as being problematic is therefore transphobic, then the word transphobic moves away from something which is deeply worrying and should be opposed wherever it can be, towards a kind of just general term, which means if you don't exactly agree with all of my demands, then I'm going to fit this word to you, and it starts becoming meaningless in most circumstances.
Chains of violence is a thought at that point, isn't it? Transfer otherwise.
Yeah, it is. And no, because obviously I've sort of observed what's gone on in kind of firsthand what's gone on in attitudes towards the gay community over the last 40, 50 years. And things are, well, certainly 5 years ago, things were dramatically different from the way they were in the 60s, 70s when I was growing up, where it had just stopped being an issue, really, most of the time. It was boring, and that's that was exactly where most of us wanted to get, was our sexuality was just of no interest to anybody, with obviously one very important exception, himself upstairs. But sure. Now we're finding that this sort of militancy and these signs saying we're coming for your kids and the like from one angle, which is turning that tide back, and we're beginning to see a drop in the or a return of the beginnings of the homophobia, because it's all tied in with trying to lump together various groups of people who really don't have terribly much in common. So you've got to be very, very careful with these things of how we do, continue to move down a society which is far kinder and which does not tolerate the kind of casual racism and othering of gay people and so on that was just typical of television programs of the 70s and 80s and hardly happens now. And that, I think, is an entirely good thing. But at the same time, not getting into a state where anybody who dares to have a view on something is in danger of being cancelled, because that will ultimately, I think, be hugely counterproductive.
There is a balance to be struck there. Graham, I'm going to ask you to comment on that, but perhaps in the context, but for now, if we can conclude, with the once with success as London Borough of Culture. It seems to me that given what we've been saying just now, there's a lot of room for, you mentioned the context of the Lords, creative expression and exploration, exposition, and debate about this sort of thing. What sort of things would be on your personal bucket list for the money to be spent, and what sorts of things are missing, and what's already quite an active part of London, and that we could actually also broadcast usefully to the rest of the city?
Yeah, I should start by pointing out the importance of culture. I mean, this is in the exchange of letters between Einstein and Freud.
Indeed.
As the way people avoid going to war is by using culture to build bonds between people so that they don't feel inclined to go to war, which is in its simplest form, that's the
this
role
the
of
the Arts Council people. Being founded in 45, I suppose, is an example of that precept, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It was founded in the war. So the way artists could help in the war effort. it was certainly realized then. Whether it's recognized now, I don't know. But it is in some places.
I suppose, is there an equivalence between the issues that we face then as a nation and the sort of cultural divisions that Miles has been talking about with some alarm?
Yeah, I did a thesis on incorporation of Islamic culture into British culture. As a
I'd
way
like
of
to read that
over religious bigotry, basically. But I mean that would be great if Wandsworth could have like the Ukrainians and the Palestinians and Israelis all having expressions in artistic form and cultural forms of what they're trying to say and what their positions are.
Yeah. I wonder, I mean, we have a diverse community, but I wonder to the extent to which the one side talks to the other. I'm really not sure about that. I mean, at an interpersonal level, hopefully, yes, not least in West Hill, perhaps, Mel.
It's very interesting. We had our full council meeting last week, and the previous one, there was a very respectful demonstration from some Palestinian supporters, but it was very civilized. They made a point, the mayor listened to their point for a while, then the mayor asked them, so fine, you've made your point, now can you be quiet, please? And they were, and it was, you know, it was good, you know, good use of democracy. They protested at a democratic meeting, and then they allowed us to get on with the business that we had to discuss, you know, issues of local importance. And last Wednesday, there weren't any. There was no protest whatsoever, as far as I could see, at the town hall. Compared to this week, Haringey, where the meeting had to be abandoned, as I understand it, because of massive attacks. Wandsworth just seems to be a place. I mean, in my ward, I've got the Ahmadiyya Muslim Mosque just outside my ward on Greshnell Ground. I've got a synagogue in my ward, again, just outside the ward in Southfields. There is the Sikh temple and a couple of churches as well within the ward. And what is very, very noticeable is how all of these institutions interact with each other. And if ever there is a threat against one of the communities, the others are out supporting them, which is really
that's
great
unsung,
to,
and yeah, yeah.
to see. And I think that's Wandsworth. And I think we will see exactly what Graham has just suggested there, is we will see alongside, you know, I'm sure some cultural events which are focused on one particular of our cultures or another. And I do hope that we don't forget the white working class culture within all of this as well. But also seeing cross-cultural developments and events and various activities as well. Because I just think that's kind of Wandsworth. I think quite a long time ago, we, you know, almost without noticing, just came to a position that we really rather like the fact that we have people from all sorts of backgrounds here, and we all learn from each other's cultures and enjoy it. And it seems to me an area where multiculturalism is working in a way that sadly is not, you know, doesn't seem to be the case all over. So I think it's great news. I think it's full marks to Kemi Akinola, the cabinet member who's led on this, deputy leader of the council, and all of her colleagues and the council officers. They've done a great job in getting us to this stage. It's extremely exciting. I'm fascinated to see what's going to emerge from it. And I do think it'll be used even further to strengthen what I think is already very good community cohesion across Wandsworth.
I'll just give an example of the Jewish community. They have things called Limud, which were all the representatives of different aspects of the community come and have a weekend of all the different cultural aspects of Judaism.
Total immersion.
I was invited as part of a sort of interfaith contingent, and it was fascinating.
Fantastic. Well,
enjoyable, yeah.
Yeah. Salam alaikum and mazel tov, gentlemen. Thank you very much. See you next time.
Cheers.
Yeah, bye.
Bye.